a previously recorded Matt Slick show.
It's Matt Slick Live. Matt is the founder and president of the Christian Apologetics Research Ministry, found online at CARM.org. When you have questions about Bible doctrines, turn to Matt Slick Live for answers, taking your calls and responding to your questions at 877-207-2276. Here's Matt Slick.
Hey everybody, how you doing out there? It's me, Matt Slick. I'm going to turn that one off. Okay. Hey, I was off yesterday, and the reason was because we had some technical difficulties. Those are resolved, and I'll be out. I won't be live Monday because I got a doctor's appointment. One of those things, timings and things like that. That's the way it goes. That's life. Okay, so if you want to give me a call, all you got to do is dial 877-207-2276. And as usual, we can take your calls, discuss whatever you want to discuss, and hopefully we'll have a good show today. So we have four open lines, 877-207-2276. Just want to let you know that if you go to the CARM website, CARM.org, on the right side of any page, you'll see, I modified the page there today, you'll see the novel for the time trap, the novella of Atheistica, and you can check out the links there and check them out if you want, if you're interested. I like to write fiction as well as theology and enjoy trying to communicate truths. So Atheistica is a novella. It's a short novel. And it's about an atheist, a billionaire who creates an atheist utopia on an island. And it goes really well for a while. And then solutions are sought. And, well, anyway. So that's what it is. You can check it out if you're interested. And also we have some schools online. You can go to the same website, CARM.org, CARM.org. On the right-hand side, you'll find the CARM Online Schools. Just look for that little laptop picture on the right-hand side. It'll click you. Or you click on that, it'll take you to where you need to be. And that's for the schools. You can check them out. So if you want to learn theology and apologetics and critical thinking, that's what you got to do. And if you do sign up for them, please give it 24 hours for the password to work. Sometimes it messes up a little bit. Usually it does not. But we are building a new website. We'll have that fixed as well. Just letting you know. You can sign up. It usually works right away. If it doesn't, we'll fix it. And I think that's that. So again, four open lines, 877-207-2276. Let's get to Oliver from Maine. Oliver, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
Doing all right. Hanging in there, man. What do you got?
So my question is on Exodus 21, verses 7 to 11.
Exodus.
If you'd like me to read it, I can real quick.
Yeah, I got it right here. The man sells his daughter as a female slave. She's not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master, who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to foreign people because of the unfairness of her. If he designates for her his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food or clothing and her conjugal rights. Okay?
So my question is, does this condone sex slavery? And also,
no.
It seems like it's for life. As for men, it's only like the 7-year situation.
Yeah. Notice it says at the end of the verse 10, conjugal rights. And usually what was happening in the context there is, you got to understand a little bit of context. Let's look at some culture. Not that this makes everything okay. It's just how things were. A woman who was not married by mid-20s was considered unfavored by God. And they often would not have anyone to marry. And a woman who was not married was at risk to some degree, depending on the familial relationships. So a daughter would be protected by the brothers and the family head, the father, as well as the extended family, cousins and things like that. If she were not to get married and the life expectancy was shorter than now, if her father were to die, well, the brothers are often with someone else, married someplace else. Who's going to take care of her? Well, then it would become necessary for her to live with one of the family members, with the mom. It just depends, you know, how variables go. People live and die and things like that. And then she would become what we called in English, you know, an old maid. And in that culture, it was a more serious issue. So what it looks like is a man sells his daughter as a female slave. We're not talking about chattel slavery, where their property and they don't have any rights. That's not how it was. She's not to go free. It looks like what was happening is that when it talks about conjugal rights, it says it's not looking about sex slavery. That's not what it is. A sex slave is someone who has no rights. They're just there for that purpose. Within the Judaistic system, the biblical system of the Old Testament, you could not have relations with anybody who's not your wife. That was just it. That's the law. So if a woman was to be sold by a father, either to pay a debt or to ensure that she would become another wife of a particular person, she'd be then taken care of, then she could not be set free from that because she's functionally married. And even though it was what we call slavery, here it's not the kind of slavery of the 1800s in America. So that's what it looks like is going on there. She has rights as a wife, and she has white rights, and as it says, if he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. Now, why would he call it conjugal rights? Well, the wife, the slave wife, became a slave, you know, but not in the, like I said, I'm going to make sure people understand this, not in the chattel system. Slaves had a lot of rights back then. So why would it talk about that? Well, it's because she would be expected to have children. And for a woman not to have children was considered a shame. And it was a lack of blessing of the Lord. So she would want to have children by him. And so he could not deny her the conjugal rights, not reduce them. So as we look at it, we go, oh, I'm starting to see, you know, it's not just the word slave, you know, it's not like that. And there's different kinds of words, or Hebrew words, for slavery. And there's ama, aruda, abed, and these have, and na'ar, hold on. And they have different kinds of meanings and emphasis in there. Shifka is another one. And, so what we see is that there were rights and obligations of slaves. They could go to war. They could inherit property. They could be in control of entire households. They were considered a member of the master's household. They were required to rest on the Sabbath. And they were to be treated gently, properly. If there's a, I forget exactly where, but if a man beats a slave and the slave dies, he was to be punished. And you know, so if with chattel slavery, it's not like that. So it's not like an unwilling woman is being sold to a master who's just a mean guy and he's having his way with her. That is not what's going on. It's most probably in the context for her protection and or to pay a debt from the family, which was what was done back then. Males and females all over the place. And she was to be regarded as a member of the household with certain rights, to be a wife as well, and not to be denied food, shelter, or conjugal rights in order to produce children. Okay?
Okay. That makes sense. Okay.
That help?
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. That answers that, yeah. Thank you.
All right, man. God bless. All right, that was Oliver from Maine. Let's get to Carl from South Carolina. Carl, welcome. You're on the air. What do you got, buddy?
Hi, Matt. Hey, Matt, I got a question. There was I was looking in on an evangelist who was around when Billy Graham was starting out by the name of Templeton. And he looked at the Bible, and there was an issue with the aging of the time of the earth. And he walked away from his faith because he said he could not believe of what the time span of what they placed in the Bible of the age of our earth, in the sense of creation, when God created the earth. And I just want to be able to witness to people. Do you have any scriptures or passages I could give to people and they say, well, the Bible says the earth is only 20,000 years old or whatnot, but here it says something different off science and other things?
Well, there aren't any scriptures that say how old the earth is. And the best that people have done is to take genealogies and add them up and go backwards, and it looks like Adam and Eve were created roughly 6,000 years ago. Now, there's a lot of legitimacy to that. However, sometimes genealogies are representative and not... there we go. The representative and not literal. Sometimes. I'm not saying that's the case in any of these, but it's just a fact we have to look in it and research. Plus, how old, how long were Adam and Eve in the garden? We don't know. How old was the earth before they were in the garden? We don't know. Now, generally, the answers to those things are, well, it's in the same day that they were created. And I have no problem with that. So, though there are some ambiguities, for the most part, the idea of the age of the earth is to be young. And this is what the Bible teaches. It's not millions of years old. Though I think a case could be made using... I heard someone speak on it, a Christian. And he spoke on it, and there's a theory out that's being worked on by some astrophysicists that... the way the Earth formed, I'm trying to remember it as I talk, the way the Earth formed was different in relationship to time as it was out there in the universe during the expansion of the universe. And so that there could be a longer period outside but a shorter period inside the solar system, kind of a thing. And it's a serious theory. But I can't remember. I'm trying to remember, because sometimes when I talk about it, it comes back to me, but it's not. So anyway, it's something else there. So how old is the earth? I don't know. But Templeton, you know, he gave up. Well, it's because he wasn't regenerate. He wasn't really saved to begin with. You know, they went out from us because they never were of us. If they had been of us, they would have remained. 1 John 2:19. So he was looking at something and judging the world by, excuse me, judging the scriptures by the world. Now, there are problems with a long age earth. And one of them, for example, is there are trees that have been fossilized in rock strata. The rock strata is like 600 million years old, and a single tree is fossilized vertically in all of them. You can't have that. In, I think it's Nebraska, there are plates of ground, like 100, 200 miles wide or something like this, where the oldest rock is on the bottom, and the newer rock's on the bottom, and the older rock is on the top. How does that happen? There are issues with the rate of rain that washes mountains down into streams. And if the Earth were billions of years old, then this would have happened years, many, many, many years ago. So now they introduced, well, it's plate tectonics, but plate tectonics doesn't seem to really answer the question in a lot of areas. And there's some stuff there. There's one other one I remember. Oh, yeah, well, when the astronauts landed on the moon, they theorized that because the Earth was that many years old and the moon came from the Earth, they theorized, billions of years ago, that the dust on the Earth, on the moon would be, I think, 8 inches, 12 inches deep, and it was only 2 inches or something like that, or an inch, which was consistent with the age of a young Earth at the rate of decay and fall of the dust. And plus there's cosmic dust that goes onto the Earth, and it should slow the Earth down due to mass transference and momentum transference. And if at the present rate, the Earth would have been maybe a lot slower if it was billions of years old. There's all kinds of problems. You want to hold after the break? Yeah, why not?
Hey, okay, I will.
Okay, hey folks, we'll be right back after these messages. Please stay tuned.
It's Matt Slick Live, taking your calls at 877-207-2276. Here's Matt Slick.
All right, welcome back to the show, everyone. Carl, are you... Whoops, I got the wrong one. Hold on. Oh, that is it. It's the right one.
You got it, Matt.
Yeah.
Hey, Matt, I agree, and I was listening to you with the moon dust, and that's actually... when they brought that up, they designed the lunar landing pod with these... feet that would actually they thought there would be like 16 feet of dust, and there was, like you said, there was only probably about 6 inches, which actually does correlate with more of a time span of like 15 or 20,000 years that they estimate the moon and stuff, the Earth But the other thing is, I've also studied that carbon dating is not accurate either.
Right.
And one thing I got to ask is, when people bring this up to me, I say, well, that the Lord is not confined or constrained by time, and His time could be a completely different in the sense of how it's defined of what we have on an earthly time. Would that be a correct thing, or would that be something that, far stretching it?
Well, when we start talking about God's relationship to time, I always kind of step back because I don't know what that is. So I don't want to say it's different. I don't want to say it's the same. I just say, can't comment.
Okay.
Because we don't know. And I don't want to speak out of ignorance. If I were to say something like that, I'd say, well, we don't know exactly, but here's a theory. And then you can work from that, and that's okay. But obviously, I would say God relates to time differently than we do. How it is, I don't know. I wouldn't say He's restricted to it the way we are. But much more than that, I couldn't venture to speak more than that. So, but I don't have any problem with the earth being very young, because God could certainly create it in 6 seconds or 6 hours or 6 days or six years. It doesn't make any difference.
Okay. Right. And then how would you address, in the sense when they say, well, like Noah would, live for 600 years or what?
Yeah.
Is there anything in the sense of that, how people address that, and how we, have to witness the people when they bring this out?
Let's say, yeah, so what?
Okay.
They were really old. What's wrong with that? Well, it can't happen. How do you know? There's a book out called Genetic Entropy, and it's talking, I need to go through it, but I know the basics, and it's that when the genes are being copied, our DNA is being copied, the copies aren't perfect. And the theory is within roughly 200 to 250 generations, the human genome won't be viable anymore. So I need to read through this and see. This seems to be the evidence. Now, if that's the case, that means that we're getting worse, not better. Well, why not? If we reverse it, then maybe we did live a long, long time. And plus, don't forget, after the flood, after the flood is when people's lifespans decreased. So one of the theories is that the canopy was protecting them from harmful cosmic rays and some other stuff, and they could live a long time. So it's no big deal. Plus, I read an article, you won't hear about this, that some people did an experiment where they took computer models of just a normal skull, human skull, at different ages, 5 years old, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50, 60, and they were able to mimic the development of the skull and pretty accurately represent what people look like in their ages, skeletal-wise. So they thought, what would happen if we just let it go for 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 700 years? And they started finding out that the skulls in the projection started looking like Neanderthal skulls. That's really funny, because the Neanderthals, when I remember, had a larger brain capacity than we do. That doesn't mean that they're smarter, but the evolutionists want to say the Neanderthals are our ancestors. Nah, I don't buy that. They're probably just cave dwellers and completely human. And it was just interesting that the science that did this, that's what they looked like. And it's like, ooh, interesting. So,
Okay. And the other last comment was, you did bring up entropy, and actually the second law of thermodynamics actually goes against evolution.
Yes,
so
it does.
It is an interesting thing in the sense of science that,
that's
law.
Another topic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Copying information, there are problems, but then they'll say it's a furthering of genetic information, and then predation and natural selection will allow certain modifications to increase or decrease. But I like to get into the issue of information theory and how that works with mathematics. And that's why I talk to some atheists about evolution. I get into that area, and that's where it really shows the weakness of evolution. But nevertheless, got to get going, okay, buddy?
Well, thank you for your time, Matt, and appreciate your ministry.
Yeah.
God bless.
God bless. All right. Okay, let's get on with Russ from Ohio. Russ, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, man, how you doing?
Doing all right. What do you got?
Hey, so I got a question that's going to happen that almost sound like a follow-up question to your last conversation, but I didn't know you were having that when I called in.
It's all right.
But nonetheless, so I'm a young earther, but I do have a question about what are your thoughts on what the word day means for the first 3 days before there's any sort of a creation of the universe and all the physics that would come into play that we're normally we define a day as the Earth's revolution around its own axis.
Yes, but
and facing the sun.
We don't know if the universe was or wasn't created until after the third day or something like that, because it says in the first verse, he created the heavens and the earth. In Jewish cosmology, there were three heavens. The first heaven was where the birds were, the second and the clouds, and the second was the star, moon, sun. The third was was the presence of God, the dwelling place of God. Now, we would think that the word heavens there would be dealing with the first two, because God's presence, his heaven, I don't know if it's created, I think it's just where he is. So heavens here, plurality, would require at least a second, first and second heavens, including the stars and everything. So that would mean that they were created. And then it says the earth was formless and void, and then let there be light. So I don't have any problem with the sun being in existence, but the earth wasn't capable. People on earth weren't capable of seeing it, if anybody was there. They weren't, but they would not be able to see it from that perspective, because the earth was forming.
But on day four, it says, let there be lights in the vault of sky to separate mm-hmm. the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark sacred times,
right.
days, and years,
mm-hmm.
and let the lights in the vault of sky to give light on earth. So it seems like he's making the sun and the moon, or we're being told on day four, he's making the sun and the moon to mark mm-hmm. the days and the years.
Yeah. And this is from the perspective of the earth. There are different ways of looking at this. And when I was younger, I read the Bible before I was a Christian. I read the first couple of chapters and I tossed it because it didn't make any sense. You can't have light without a sun, and you can't have plants without the sunlight. And, you know, it just didn't make sense. So I tossed it. And then a few years later, I read an article from a secular scientist who said, what would you see if you were on the face of the earth while the earth was developing? He said the sun would be out there, but you wouldn't be able to see it because of the atmosphere. And he gave the formulas and the whole reasons it would be cloudy. But the action of the light and photosynthesis would clear up the atmosphere and you'd see the sun. And it caused me to go back to the Bible and go, wait a minute, that's what it's saying here. Not exactly. Let me, after the break, let me expand a little bit more. We'll talk about that some more. Hey, folks, be right back after these messages. Please stay tuned.
It's Matt Slick Live, taking your calls at 877-207-2276. Here's Matt Slick.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Let's get back to Russ from Ohio. Russ, you still there?
Still here, Matt.
All right. So, okay, where were we?
I was asking what's your take on the word day.
Oh, that's right.
The first 3 days in Genesis 1, before God creates the earth, the sun, and the moon on day four.
Well, I have no problem with it being 24-hour periods. It doesn't bother me.
No, that's fine, and that's what I get out of most people, and I'm not saying I have a problem with them. I'm just asking, as a guy who's studied Hebrew language or whatever, why... So you're a guy that always says, write out the definition, we need terms. So if you were to write out the term definition of a day, I would say it is the amount of time for the earth to revolve around its axis, and blah, 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 because of the sun. So we see the sun once a day. But before any of that exists, there's no real reason to believe that the earth is revolving around its axis because of the gravitation of the sun if it doesn't exist. So I'm just curious.
Revolving around an axis is different than the gravitational pull of the sun, because they're different. But we could have the first and second day. Generally speaking, Yom in Hebrew, when it's with ordinal numbers, means 24 hours. Normally, except for the seventh day, which doesn't have a setting. It just continues on. So this is why I go, well, not always. There's an exception to it. That's normal. Okay. The normal understanding of it. Okay.
Right. So it says morning and it says evening.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no sunrise and sunset if there's no sun. So
well,
that's just a.
Well, you can't go. You just can't say there isn't one. Morning and evening. How do you have an evening if there isn't some axial rotation? Because the sun's out there, you can have a morning, you can have an evening. By definition, those require the sunlight. That's what it is. That's how it's understood. I know of no place where morning and evening doesn't mean morning and evening in the Bible. So, the idea of what the earth is here is very interesting. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the framework hypothesis. Have you, in regard to this?
No.
Is day one and day four relate? Day two and day five and day three and day six. So because on day one there's light, on the second day, on day three, for example, we have the sun and the moon. So it's like, oh, light with light. And then you go on, land and plants and oceans and stuff and fish and things like this. And so some people wonder if there's a reason for that. And the question then becomes, how literal do we take Genesis 1 here in these days? I think we can take it literally. I think we can take some of it figuratively. I think there's a mix in there. And I think Genesis 1 is brilliantly written. And I mean geniusly written. When you study it, you start seeing patterns. You start seeing things. Even the things that are omitted are significant. And so there's just a lot there. There is. But anyway, okay?
Okay. Thanks, Matt.
All right, man. God bless, buddy. All right.
You take care.
You too. All right, let's get over to Robert from Georgia. Robert, welcome. You're on the air.
Hello, Matt. I hope and pray things go well for you on Monday with the doctor.
it's just one of those things you got to do every few years.
Okay. All right.
So.
Good. I did talk to you last week about the VHI, and you offered some very helpful advice, yes. And I really appreciate it. I do have a question about Acts 9.
Acts 9, okay.
And Paul's conversion, Acts 9:10 through 19.
Yep.
And we're going to some Armenian friends who said that they had a really different perspective than I had. I really thought Paul's conversion there is a tremendous demonstration of God's work and sovereignty.
Absolutely.
In the conversion of sinners.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But they tend to think that it was something more like just redirecting Paul. All Christ had to do is redirect him a bit because he was so passionate in seeking God as a Pharisee. And I don't see Paul supporting any of that later on in Romans and Corinthians. Just wondered if you had any thoughts about that conversation.
Yeah, it's theological ignorance to say God just had to redirect him. It's not what the text says. And when people say things like that in regard to this sovereign act of God, what they're doing is denying the sovereignty of God. And they're giving sovereignty to man. And they're saying they just need to be redirected because they have goodness and ability within themselves. And that's what they're basically saying. And this is a faulty assumption. So if I were talking to them, I would ask them, can you show me that in Scripture? Can you just show me where it's just a redirection? Because it's not what the case is. What we see is Paul going around killing Christians. He'd been raised as a Jew, and he hated what they were doing. He probably was the one, Saul, standing next to the people when they stoned Stephen. And he's going out to kill more people, and then he's knocked off his horse. You guys say, you can have fun with him and say, well, yeah, the redirection was downward. Off of his horse, onto his rear. And then he was blinded and basically terrified. And so, is that just a redirection? And I'd force them to look at the text. Show me that in the Scriptures. Show me that in the Scriptures. And then when they can't, I'd say, please don't add to the Word of God. Don't make it fit what you feel it must be. This is what it says. That is what it is. And it says, Jesus said that he is a chosen instrument of mine. And the word there is ekklege. And the word is used in different contexts, but it deals with the sovereignty of God and his right to choose to do what he wants with, well, what he chooses. That's
right.
What's going on there.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Right.
And it occurs.
Fun to listen to. Thanks uh-huh. a lot. That's fun. Good.
Well, okay.
Have a good night.
You too. God bless.
Thank you.
Let me just kind of go on. Did a little bit of research here just while we're talking. The word occurs seven times, and the verse we're just talking about, also in Romans 9:11, so that God's purpose according to his choice would stand, not because of works. And Romans 11:5, at the present time a remnant according to God's gracious choice. Romans 11:7, what Israel is seeking it had not obtained, but those who were chosen obtained it. In Romans 11:28. But for the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. In 1 Thessalonians 1:4, knowing, brethren, that beloved by God, his choice of you. 2 Peter 1:10, be all the more diligent to make certain about his calling and choosing you. For as long as you practice these things, you'll never stumble. So this talk about God's choice, God's work, not about man's ability, God's choice. And that's what's going on. Ekklesia, and that's the word in Acts 9:15, where Jesus says that Paul's a chosen instrument. Let's get to Christian from Raleigh, North Carolina. Christian, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, man? I'm a big fan of your show. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hey, no problem, man. What do you got?
Well, I just had a little question. I'm sorry, I'm going to change the topic a little bit. I am still sticking to Genesis. I just had a question. I wanted to get your thoughts on Genesis chapter 6.
Okay,
there's a theory going around. I'm sure you probably already know. You're probably privy to it. But there's a book that I purchased a couple of years ago. It's called Genesis 6 Conspiracy by Gary Wayne. And the theory is that Genesis chapter 6 is talking about angelic beings. And then there are other scholars who believe that it's talking about Sethites, you know.
Yeah, I don't buy that
one.
The Sethite theory didn't come into view until the 1500s, when the Christian church started to become ridiculed for this position. So the church, the early church and the Jews universally taught that Genesis 6 was about fallen angels having relations with women. And when you go to Genesis 6:9, it says there that Noah was perfect in all his generations. So it seems to hint at the idea of his ancestry is good and pure. And so one of the theories is that the reason the flood came was to wipe out the half-breeds so that the Messiah line would not be destroyed. And it says, Jesus says in Matthew 24, Luke 17, that as it was in the days of, so it shall be the days of the coming. As it was in Noah, that is. It'll be like that again. And so that may be happening again. And we've got a break coming up. I'm going to go quickly. I'll say this quickly. If you go to Daniel 2:43, and it's a really interesting verse here in Daniel 2:43. And what happens there is the statue of Nebuchadnezzar. And in the feet of clay is supposedly historically believed to be our time now. And what it says is, and that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, that's the feet, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, that they can't be people. Because it says they will combine with men, otherwise they would be. See the problem there? Hold on, we got a break coming up. Folks, be right back after these messages. We'll talk more about Genesis 6. Stay tuned.
It's Matt Slick Live, taking your calls at 877-207-2276. Here's Matt Slick.
All right, buddy. Welcome back to the show. Let's get back to Christian from Raleigh. You still there?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, did that information help you? It was kind of quick, but did it help?
Yes, sir. Yes,
okay.
Sir. You helped me pretty good.
You got any more questions about it?
Well, no. I just wanted to get your finishing thoughts before the break. You were kind of on a roll there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I affirm my position is that the Nephilim are the half-breeds between fallen angels and women. That's what I affirm. I think the text supports that. And we don't know what the capabilities of angels are, but we do know that they are could be very powerful. One killed thousands of people in a night. Another one, they can appear as people. You can't even tell they're not people. So they have some great abilities. And so this is what the church taught. This is what the Jews always taught. And, you know, I don't appeal to that kind of a thing very often outside of Scripture, but it's pretty much that's what the only position that they held until the 1500s when it became ridiculed. And they, oh, let's make it the Sethites. I just said, no, it's what the text says. So stick with it. So, no problem. Now, here's the thing. In Matthew 24, Luke 17, Jesus says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. For they were eating, they were drinking, they were giving in marriage till the day that Noah entered the ark. The flood came and took them all away. And Luke 17 says, the flood came and destroyed them all. So those are the ones who were taken with the wicked. In Matthew 13:30, Jesus says, the parable of the wheat and the tares. He says, allow both to grow together until the time of the harvest. I'll say to the reapers, first gather the tares. The first ones gathered at the return of Christ are not the good, but the wicked. Now, it's consistent with Matthew 24, Luke 17, and with Genesis 6. Because it was the wicked who were destroyed in the flood. They were the ones who were taken. Just interesting. Right? So what might that mean? Let me run with it a little bit because we only have one caller waiting. If what Jesus said is true, which has to be the case, could it be then that in the last days, this kind of interference of the angelical realm will be happening again or continue to happen? And when it says in Matthew 13:30, to allow them to go together, the wicked and the good, and the wicked will be taken out of the kingdom of God. Then that's really interesting. Because most people say that we're going to be taken out of the earth. But the Bible's teaching that the wicked will be taken out of the kingdom. It teaches the opposite. Now we're going to be taken out in the rapture. That's going to happen. But when's it going to happen? Well, it has to happen at the return of Christ because the wicked are taken first. And then the good are taken. The new heavens and new earth are made. And I can connect those dots. So this is not the common position. But when I show people this in Scripture, and I tell you, read these, just look what it says, and they're blown away. Like, wow. You know, this is what the Scriptures teach. So, particularly in Daniel 2:43, which is an eschatological view towards the end times, they will combine in the seed of men. And I remember hearing a commentator say that the construction of the Hebrew there can't be that the they are people because they will combine with people. So the implication is they're not. So what's going on? And then I can get some more, you know, theories and stuff. And this kind of stuff is interesting. And when I read the Scriptures, I don't come up with the same thing that others do. Because I'm just reading. And wait a minute, what's that saying? I just do a research. And now I don't have to worry about making it fit my denominational purview. Otherwise, I'll get kicked out. I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, you're not reading your beliefs into text.
Right, right.
Very important to have contact. You're right. You're absolutely right.
That's right. And so my question is, in Matthew 24, Luke 17, the ones who are taken are the wicked. Not the good. Two men in the field, one is taken, one is left. That's the wicked. Why is it, and everybody just go read. Start Matthew 24, Luke 17, start around verse 30. Just look for the, as it was in the days of Noah. And then compare the chapters. Matthew 24, Luke 17, just compare the words and see who's taken. And at the end of Luke 17, they ask Jesus, where are they taken? He actually answers. And he says, where the bodies are, the vultures gather. That's what he says. And I'm just going to have, this would be fun. This is fun, entertainment for Friday. I think it's in Revelation, let's see, I'm going to find it. There we go, it's Revelation 16. And it says this, I saw coming out of the mouth, this is Revelation 16:13. Saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs. Now what do frogs do? They hop. One taken, one's left? I don't know. For there are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. Now wait a minute. If Matthew 24 and Luke 17 say the wicked are taken, and Jesus says they're taken to a place of destruction, could it be that Revelation 16 is talking about the unclean spirits that could take them, the wicked, and take them to Armageddon to be destroyed? Maybe. Maybe not. I have no idea. But I think it's fun to put those together and make you think and scratch your head and go, I'm going to go check this out. So I don't know if it's right or wrong. Interesting, though, huh?
Very interesting. You could fall into a rabbit hole.
Yes, it is. I love those. I love doing those studies because you learn a lot and then you often don't come up with an answer anyway. So,
<Yeah. laughs>
but there you go. All right? All right, man.
Thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
All right, man. God bless. Well, that was for fun, folks. I don't know what all those things mean together, but they're interesting. All right, let's get to Andrew from Ohio. Andrew, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, Matt. I was just reading this article by the American Humanist Association.
Humanist
Association.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
uh-huh.
what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just amazing. It's called Why We Reject the Bible. It's just absurd to me.
Of course it is.
I've seen every atheist, they bring up this. It's amazing to me, even though I want to talk about the New Testament, who wrote that. But I want to bring up this first.
Sure.
In Matthew 16, I think it's the last verse of Matthew 16.
Okay.
Is it 16:28, I think?
It says, 28, truly I'll say that there's some, those who are standing here do not taste death till they see the Son of Man coming in His kingdom. You know, I've talked to humanists, atheists about this, and I often say to them, why don't you do some homework before you start asking these questions?
And then go to the next verse. Yeah, go to the next verse. It's about the transfiguration.
Right. Right.
They can't even go to another chapter. And I've seen Aaron Ra bring this up.
Aaron Ra. Yeah, I debated him once, and he wants nothing to do with me anymore. I wonder why. He doesn't want to talk to me. We'll give you the time of day. So, at any rate, yeah, you know.
Another thing was, they don't know who wrote the New Testament. They don't know who wrote the Gospels. And what I find funny when I read Paul's letters, all these, Mark and Luke are both mentioned together. You look at 2 Timothy 4:11, they're both mentioned together. And Philemon 24, I believe.
Look, here's the thing, is that the early church knew who wrote the New Testament documents. When you talk to humanists, look, let me just tell you, they don't have all their logical paws in the litter box. They generally can't think their way out of a wet paper bag. And when we come down to the issue of arguing with them about the facts, they don't care about the facts. If you're to cite church fathers in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, these are the writings that were attributed to John and Peter. They just reject it. Well, it didn't happen. It doesn't mean anything. You know, it doesn't matter what you say to them. So what I do is I work on their presuppositions, and I knock out the foundations of their basic premises that they use to even argue, and I show them that they don't have a leg to stand on. I enjoy doing it. I'm sorry, but I do. Because I love talking to atheists and humanists. I do. I just love it. They're basically nominalists, which means that there are no transcendentals, there are no universals. And without those things, then they become the ones who determine truth. And when you are the one who becomes the truth determiner, both morally and whatever, you're going to get whatever information you can that bolsters your assumptions and your presuppositions. And that's what happens with the atheists and the humanists. They're generally the same. And I love discussing. What's that?
So you should start with presuppositionalists, then maybe classical apologetics, then evidence. Because that's what I have difficulty with. I like more evidence. But I like Sci-Fi Bruden Kate, but
yeah,
I don't want to go 100% presuppositionalist.
Well, look at this. If they're going to say, for example, that that the New Testament authors aren't known, I'm going to say, how do you know they're not known? What's the evidence you have for what you're saying, because you make a statement based upon the facts and what you believe. So you believe something. Hopefully you don't believe something because there's no evidence for it. What's the evidence that they're not written by who they said they were, particularly when we as Christians have the evidence that they are? So can you please work on counter evidence? What I'm doing is talking presuppositionally, using terms couched in evidence.
Well, now they're coming up with that Jesus never existed. All these authors are coming up. And it's just absurd to me that we have
Here's
Calvinists,
the response.
We have Josephus.
Here's the response.
Go ahead.
You just say, look, take your right hand and put it in front of your face. And they go, what? Yeah. And now look to your left. Yeah. Now slap yourself upside the head. Saying the idea that Jesus didn't exist is just ludicrous.
It is.
And they're just, you know, and I want to find out. At that point, I'm really going to go presup on them. I will just take their worldview apart. And I'll say, okay, if you're going to say he doesn't exist, or he never existed, then can you please tell me what was the purpose and the reason of the New Testament to be written? And they're going to have to give some answers. Well, we don't know. What do you mean you don't know? You're not thinking this through? They'll give answers. And I'll tell you, when they come up with answers, I rip them apart like a monkey on a cupcake. Shredded. They don't like talking to me, but I love talking to them.
Well, this is why I like evidence, but they just reject it. We find evidence. Like, before 1961, they'd say, oh, Pontius Pilate never existed. Then we find that stone.
Yeah.
Oh, well, the Pool of Siloam didn't exist.
Here.
Oh, we found that. Let me help you out.
Yeah, they just, let me help you out with something.
Yeah,
what evidence is. Evidence is an abstraction. Now, the illustration I use is there's footprints in the mud outside of a house that's been broken into, and the window's open. Now, the footprints are evidence that fit the theory that a vandal entered in through that window. If I were to say those footprints, and those footprints are in the state of Ohio, and I'm in Idaho, those footprints are the demonstration I love my wife, then the evidence doesn't fit the theory, therefore it's not evidence. Evidence becomes supportive inside of an assumption, inside of a theory. So you have to understand that, about the issue of evidence as a concept. Footprints is just a physical formation. What theory do you have that you fit that phenomena into? So when they say they want evidence, then what I'm going to say is, I need to know the criteria you have to justify what evidence is or is not within your worldview. And this is where they really back it up. Because it's really important to talk on that level with them, and then you'll see they have all kinds of problems. Okay? We're out of time. I'd expand more, but we're out.
All right,
buddy? All right.
All right. Thank you so much, Ken.
Okay, that was Andrew. Hey, sorry, Ron. And let's see, Larry and Ernie. Hey, I'll be back on the air. Oops, sorry about that. I'll be back on the air on Tuesday. I'm off Monday, doctor's appointment. We'll talk to you then. Have a great weekend, folks. Bye.